My name is Paul Holdengraber, and I'm the director of Live from the New York Public Library. Though summer has gone by now, and I should have a new motto, I could not really find one. So I'm still saying that the goal of Live from the New York Public Library is to make the lions roar, to make this heavy institution dance, to make it levitate when we are successful. I would like to welcome you all to our fall Live from the New York Public Library lineup. And tonight is a bittersweet farewell to Jonathan Lethem. More about that later on. It probably won't be a real farewell, but I took it upon myself, really, to invite Jonathan, not because he's written a new book. You know, usually the case is writer writes book and pays penance by coming to the library to present book. I mean, that's the usual way things happen. Publishers call me, publicists, a whole industry is behind the... I actually would someday like to do something on the book tour as a phenomenon. Maybe the last event I do will be on the book tour. But here, really, it is simply because I felt that the moment had come and it was necessary to invite him before he leaves us to have an evening with him. So the reason of having Jonathan today is not a new book, but an oeuvre, to use the French word, a whole body of work and certain obsessions that we share and that we will discuss. Later this season, I invite you to come hear conversations between Angela Davis and Toni Morrison, David Grossman and Nicole Krauss, Antonio Damasio and Marina Abramovitz, Ruth Reichel, René Redzepi, and David Chang, an evening celebrating the National Lampoon, the Robert Silver's lecture this year given by Derek Walcott, and another by Slavoj Žižek, as well as an evening with Lady Antonia Fraser, Keith Richards, Zadie Smith, and Jay-Z. Now, Keith Richards in particular, I was inspired to invite him because you may or may not know this, but Keith Richards has said that when he was a child, he wanted to be a librarian. He erred slightly from that, vocation. He wanted to be a librarian. He said that there are two institutions that matter greatly when he was growing up in England. One was the church, which belongs to God, and the other one is the library, which belongs to the people. He said the library is a great equalizer. So with that in mind, I felt that we had to invite Keith Richards, mainly to speak about his vocation, which he didn't follow. I would like to encourage all of you to become friends of the New York Public Library for just $40 a year, which is rather a cheap date. You can get discounts on all live tickets and much more. As always, I would like to thank our independent bookseller, 192 Books, Jonathan Lethem, will sign books after our conversation. Before signing, there will be time for a Q&A, a question. I have calculated this. Takes about 52 seconds to ask. A good question about 47 seconds. Mine will always be quite a bit longer. Keep yours brief and let's have fun hearing the answers. More about that later. I would also like to greet all of those of you who are watching us online on Fora TV. I'm told we are being streamed live online now. It sounds quite wonderful. So hello to everyone out there. Jonathan Lethem is an American novelist who was born in 1964 in Brooklyn, New York. The son of a painter, he followed in the footsteps of his father when he enrolled in the High School of Music and Art, where he painted, made animated films, and generally nurtured his identity as a visual artist. At Bennington College in the early 1980s, he abandoned painting for writing and dropped out midway through his sophomore year. Lethem spent the next decade living in Berkeley, California, where he worked in as a bookstore clerk, and more about that too, and wrote in his free time. His first short novel, Gun, with occasional music, was published in California in 1994. Since then, he has returned to Brooklyn and published many acclaimed novels, including The Fortress of Solitude and Motherless Brooklyn, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award. His stories and essays have appeared in The New Yorker, Harper's, Esquire, McSweeney, The New York Times, and others. One of the essays, The Ecstasy of Influence, A Plagiarism Rather Than On Plagiarism, has had a huge influence on my thinking. The best thing ever written of its kind, and I'm not sure anything like this has ever been written, so it's the best in its kind, alone in its kind. I highly recommend that you read it now, tonight, if you have not yet. It is in Harper's Magazine, February 2007. I suggest you download it and upload your mind. Leatham is a recipient of the MacArthur's Fellowship Award, which is called the Genius Grant, and his most recent book is Chronic City. This fall, he will relocate to California, where he will replace the late David Foster Wallace as Roy Disney, Class of 51 Chair in Creative Writing at Pomona College. Please welcome him to this stage.
You're right.
Thank you, Paul.
Well, you're very, very welcome.
Nice. Yeah, it was nice.
It's good.
I'll try to live up to it.
Pronounced your name correctly.
And you pronounced my name correctly.
Because when we spoke initially, you were telling, I said Leatham, and you said, no, think of it as Liso.
Yeah,
Leatham.
If you think of lethal, you'll never.
I'll know that I'm pronouncing. Yeah. Now, I was wondering, because I spent yesterday night, as I usually do, not sleeping. I wonder, do you suffer from insomnia?
Well, I don't have the luxury of insomnia right now because I have a six-month-old baby in the house. So my lack of sleep is dictated by this little beautiful, 12-pound person. And so when I can sleep, I do. When I'm allowed to sleep, I do. Actually, I have insomnia when I'm traveling. I had insomnia last night, and I do think of it as a luxury. It's like
a luxury to have insomnia.
Yeah, I think so.
How do you mean?
Well,
this is quite interesting.
Those hours alone at night thinking, I used to look at it as some sort of, don't you find that a lot of the things that were once oppressive become your pleasures in life, like flossing. I used to think it was really, even to have to go to sleep when I was very young, I felt burdened by it. Now, of course, that became one of my pleasures. And then it seemed it was robbed if I was suffered insomnia. But now I feel, if I can lie awake alone in a darkened room and just be by myself, that's not so bad. That's not so bad. I've learned to savor it.
I feel the way I express it always is that I feel that I keep the night company.
Uh-huh. Yeah, the hour, there's a poet I know named Lauren Bosolaro who has a book called The Hour Between Wolf and Dog. I don't know if she made up that phrase or not, but
that's another phrase that probably will keep me up at night.
Yeah.
Now, you wrote this little essay. I'll read the first paragraph. It's quite a paragraph. It's called, So Who is Perkis Tooth Anyway? I'm on stage after giving a reading, blinking in confusion again at a question. I've been asked by a member of the audience. The question is one I anticipated and rehearsed answering for years before I was ever faced with it, and which, as it happens, I answered aloud in public a few dozen times already by now. You'd think I know the answer to it. You'd think I'd memorized the better answers I've given in the past, might have honed a version of a sincere reply I'd be comfortable offering up, or else honed a lie or a jape, does one say? A jap?
Jape.
A jape. or a confection to stand in its place, one to entertain the audience and the questions asker, and in the process distract them from noticing I'd avoided the question. Or I can hear you suggesting I might simply reply with humble, unrehearsed honesty, as if the question had never occurred to me before, but was certainly worth an answer. The difficulty is that at this moment, I can no longer recall what I believe to be the truth. So, in the spirit that you just outlined, I'd like to say that the questions I will be asking to you today are very open source. They are very much based on our affection, I think, for Lewis Hyde and perhaps for Lawrence Lessig and mm-hmm. for how we met around Suzanne Vega. And some of them are my own, but many of them actually come from members of the public here, some of your fans. It's a wonderful mashup of questions.
Great.
So some of them are mine, some of them are only partially mine, and some of them are absolutely not mine. Now, I think what will be interesting, based on what I read before, will be to see how these questions come to you, how the audience later on asks you their questions. You can't ask the question that I've already asked that you've sent to me. And also, I'll be interested in your responses. Maybe some of the questions I will ask you, you have answered many times, as you said. Now, in the introduction you wrote to A Meaningful Life by L.J. Davis, you mentioned the complexly uncomfortable facts in the case are the facts of my childhood. It has fueled your writing, you write. How would you define that discomfort?
Well, what I'm thinking about in that introduction to L.J. Davis's book,
it's a marvelous book,
A Meaningful Life, is, again, Dean Street. You know, a couple of blocks of a street in Brooklyn in the early 1970s, that for me have been, you know, a kind of, they were a stage where drama of coming of age was enacted, and they're permanently mysterious, charged, uncomfortable, attractive, you know, romantic, a few hundred yards of pavement and slate and, you know, and a wall of row houses, brownstones and brick row houses in Brooklyn, that by now are, you know, gorgeous. And all those houses, when they change hands for millions of dollars.
You mean gentrified?
They're gentrified. They were always gorgeous, but they were decrepit. And their beauty was in ruins when I came to consciousness in that neighborhood, and my parents were bohemians. My father is a painter; he's still alive. They were committed radicals, which doesn't mean that their commitments or their beliefs were necessarily always consistent or completely well worked out, but they projected a very powerful image of a possible world, and an idealistic notion that I only gradually came to understand was a countercultural myth. It wasn't the center of the American story, even then, and it certainly was about to be, you know, shrunken down to a very small margin in the story of American culture. But, you know, you take your parents, you take your life, you take the block you grew up on, you take the world you're given it as a child.
You can't quite choose.
It's the universe.
Right.
So my parents' ideals said that as a poor, left-wing, bohemian, scruffy, white family, we were allowed to take possession of one of these houses in this neighborhood full of abandoned houses, Dominican families, Puerto Rican families, and a very small handful of the very first, you know, ambitious gentrifiers, the brownstoners, they call themselves, whom we resembled but believed ourselves to be apart from. They had a program of displacement and gentrification. We were coming to live in a neighborhood. And in many ways, that ideal was enacted. I went to the public schools while all the other white kids I could see around me were being exported, not distantly, but exported to Brooklyn Heights, to St. Anne's, or to Brooklyn Friends, or Packer Collegiate. I was, you know, at one point I was one of, I think, three white children in an entire school, PS 38 on the corner of Nevin Street and Dean. In other words, I was a very weird kind of reverse minority, packed full of this passionate, idealistic belief that the civil rights era represented a triumphant and complete story, that racism had been eradicated in our society, because my parents were so defiantly proud of their participation in that story, and rightly. Of course, we always knew, if you weren't 6 years old, that the world wasn't that simple. But I had to learn it very, very, very gradually and emerge from this script to understand that what was, what was passionately wished by my parents in installing me in this situation was not something I could make reflected in the situation as I experienced it. That in fact, I was going to be a kind of subject to an involuntary experiment in, I was an emissary, basically. And I've often tried to speak of this in terms of a kind of theater, because it always, when I wrote about being bullied in Fortress of Solitude, what I wanted to capture most of all was the sense in which it was like had qualities of being a conversation and a game and a transaction and a dance. It had so many scripts layered so deeply inside of it, all of them, of course, completely beyond the enunciation of any child or any of the participants, even a grown-up who intervened, could never begin to unpack what was going on. But it was there anyway. I knew, and the other children knew, and we were, in a sense, putting on a little show about it over and over again, a very uncomfortable show at times.
That's uncomfortable.
Yeah. So, L.J. Davis, right. So there's this terrific, neglected novelist among the brownstoners, and proudly, L.J. will be the first to tell you, he came to renovate brownstones. He came to buy up as many of them as cheaply as he could and make them look good and help improve that neighborhood. He wrote cover stories for New York Magazine, circa 1973, saying, Brooklyn is where it's at. I mean, the kind of story you saw again in the 90s when it really was plausible. It was a little bit ludicrous to write that story in 1973, but he was willing something, along with a scattered handful of other people, he was willing something into existence. Well, LJ, who both sent his children to the private schools in Brooklyn Heights and adopted a pair of black daughters from the surrounding impoverished neighborhood, so his own house was a kind of like an allegory of the contradictions in this neighborhood. He also wrote these unbelievably dark, unflinching accounts in these novels of what it really was like there then. And, there's very little else in the way of evidence. Paula Fox's Desperate Characters is another tiny shred of evidence. You can catch a hint of it there, but LJ was even deeper inside that experience. And so it was immensely moving to me to have the chance to reintroduce that book of his. Because it's
which now one finds quite easily, the New York Review of Books.
It's as near a novel can come to being like a documentary film about the place I grew up in.
When you think about your parents, do you ever think about growing up with them? Do you think of the Philip Larkin poem, This Be the Verse?
No, I don't really. I mean, my relationship to my parents is complicated and in many different ways. My mother, who was she was a New York kid. She came from Queens. She went to public school. She was street savvy. And she was the reason that my parents felt confident moving into that neighborhood in many ways. She knew how to relate to all kinds of neighbors. She knew how to navigate. My father was a farm boy. He grew up in the Midwest, was the black sheep of a large Midwestern family, discovered he wanted to be a painter, came to New York, went to Paris on a Fulbright. But he was not worldly about city life in the way my mother was. So all well and good, except then my mother began to be sick and eventually to die in the middle of my childhood. The script kind of got broken.
Right. You were 14.
And as long as she was there, there was a kind of... She was a brilliant emissary. She was a real New Yorker. She had... when you see me depicting a character in, like, Motherless Brooklyn, like Frank Minna, this, guy who goes into every store and talks the language at every storefront and knows how to play every, knows how to work all those scripts in the theater of a Brooklyn or a Queens neighborhood. That was my mother. But we lost our navigational system, when she died.
You have described Manhattan as a human tribe dry run for the virtual reality, a place both persistently real and unreal. Elsewhere, you have said New York was a virtual reality for a long time before there ever even was a description or idea of it. Chronic City takes place in a nebulous Manhattan, existing somewhere between the real and unreal. Why does Manhattan, more than any other city or place, strike you as a virtual reality?
Well, I mean, it's a remark that I don't want to become too ponderous trying to flesh it out. It's a provocative remark, but I do feel, when you think about the story of New York City, it's the future. It's this secular, commercial metropolis. It's the first great city founded for other than nationalistic or religious purposes. It's founded as a commercial venture, right? And it becomes a permanent laboratory for enterprise, experiment, invention, and then it also becomes the great capital for, it takes over from Paris at some point in the 20th century and becomes indisputably the capital of arts culture. It broadcasts the most powerful and therefore the most universally resented image of its own importance, self-involvement, self-enclosure, and the place where fake reality was invented. Madison Avenue is the place where or Madison Avenue and Hollywood are the two places where
I was about to say,
the idea of selling the sizzle, not the steak, arises. And what is virtual reality but the sizzle and not the steak? It's the invention of the fake. is centered in the life of this place.
So it's natural in some way that now you are off to California, you know, having on this stage Werner Herzog not so long ago. He says, you know, Los Angeles is the only city with substance in America.
Yeah.
So, which is, of course, also quite a provocation. So you're leaving us for another fake reality.
Well,
is that right?
I don't think anyone has the luxury of living in a real reality anymore. I don't even worry about it. I mean, that's really one of the subjects of Chronic City is quit worrying. The intermingling happened. We're just going to have to negotiate it now. You know, the virtual and the real, you know, the Reese's peanut butter cup is done. It's, you know, the chocolate and the peanut butter are completely together. And it's not a question anymore of like somehow sorting it out or purify, you know, like, oh, let's create some, reinstate the boundaries of the real and exclude the virtual. It's so completely over. It's not even something that I think we should be worrying about in those terms.
So it doesn't make you anxious?
Well, it makes me very anxious, but it's, the anxiety is in this task of making a meaningful life inside this fact and embracing it adequately and negotiating it, you know, honorably, not somehow rewinding the tape.
You have said that your trip about your trip to Pomona, you told Scott Timberg, somebody I knew from my California days, that you are choosing to live near the Claremont campuses because I am all about, and I quote you here, middle-aged family values, lifestyles right now. Now, can this be true?
Yes.
You, well, really?
You know, of course, absolutely. I mean, I'm here playing the, you know, obliging the sort of wishful, exciting image of the, you know, the solo operator, the independent operator, the life of the mind. But I've made this enormous commitment to my family. I have these two tiny children. I have tried to whittle things like book touring down to the very minimum. You know, I used to be able to, you know, pretend to be in a rock band and fool around with collaborations with filmmakers or whatever. I have to be very, very, I have to lead a very simple life now. If I'm ever going to write a novel again, it has to be just about the only thing I do besides, you know, changing diapers and making meals. And this teaching job is marvelous.
It's a dream come true. It's a complicated dream come true.
Yeah, sure, it is complicated, but it's not. I'm not ambivalent about it. It's a very, I mean, leaving New York City is bittersweet for me. What's being left behind, friends, walking on Dean Street, being in this library, all sorts of things, that's bittersweet. But what I'm being drawn to, I have no hesitations about. It's a kind of a fulfillment, actually, of a lifelong, you know, flirtation with academia. I've always loved that environment. And, you know, even when I dropped out of college, I moved to Berkeley, began living right in the shadow of that gigantic university there, pretty much only dated grad students and was mostly taken for a grad student by people there, and worked in a bookstore where all I did was sell, you know, university press books to my new friends. And I for a long time I prided myself on being the only, not only non-professor, but the only person without even a bachelor's degree who'd written an academic satire, because I did write one a long time ago. Called As She Climbed Across the Table. So this environment has always been very attractive and charged for me. I think of it frequently I think of it in terms of my parents' idealistic, utopian notions about creating a sacred space, an exalted space where people can live in a atmosphere of a devotion to the arts or to culture, to the life of the mind, where special level of civility or a sublime perfection of everyday life might be attained. Of course, this is exactly what's always doomed to failure. It was doomed in my parents' idealization, and I'm sure, you know, anyone who's familiar with university settings, knows how short they fall of utopian aspiration. But it's the effort, it's the yearning, it's the notion that there might be an enchanted zone, there might be a place where something utopian can be enacted, even if very briefly. I mean, this is really one of my obsessions in my work, is the temporary utopia.
The brief encounter.
Yeah, you know, I mean, in Fortress of Solitude, you see the character passing through this idealization of the moment when hip-hop was invented in Brooklyn, you know, when it was a kind of pure folk art, not yet commodified. People plugged turntables into the lampposts and suddenly there'd be a party. This was temporarily a real thing. And then again, he goes to the science fiction convention, which, however homely that kind of gathering may be, it is like a hotel in the Midwest suddenly gets taken over by people who all feel and think and believe a certain way, and they just live there and dwell there for, 72 extraordinary hours, and then they all take off their costumes and go back to their day jobs. But for a little while, there was this utopian moment there, and this constant pursuit of, Burning Man in the desert. The idea of there's a writer named Hakim Bey who describes this thing called TAZ, the temporary autonomous zone, that it's a condition that you brew up, and then you go and you dwell there as long as it can be sustained, and then you accept that it's going to dissolve.
And that's what academia will be, do you think?
Right, of course. It's going to be Burning Man night and day.
Yeah.
I will be on fire, in fact. I think it does describe, anyway, some of my attraction to that environment, and also my reservations, or the things that have kept me
fear.
I mean, when I got to Bennington and it didn't sustain me, I was too quickly disenchanted. You know, I dropped out of college in a kind of spirit of, you can't fire me, I quit. The minute anything was wrong, it was all wrong for me. So this is also a chance to,
find resonance and wonder, and find maybe some level of attention.
Yes, maybe, and maybe get health insurance for the whole family. I mean, it's a very simple form of security. I am, I'm pushing 50, and I don't want to be kind of scrapping and on the road and doing these impromptu gigs all the time for the quick, honorarium. I want to stay home with the kids, and this is it's a blessing.
I kind of want your life when you describe it that way. Yeah. Just having turned 50, very recently, and getting
happy birthday.
Thank you. Getting my first pair of jeans after 33 years. Yeah. I never, the last time I wore a pair of jeans was when I was 17. It feels good. Before firing yourself or leaving or abandoning academia as a student in Bennington, you found ways of entertaining yourself there quite deeply. And I must say, the parts of you I love best are the obsessive parts, the parts that are just totally and utterly absorbed by something. And in this particular case, what you were so utterly absorbed by was creating this film society.
I ran the Benetton Film Society.
It's Film Society, yeah. And I don't remember it because the first teaching gig I had was at Williams College, mm-hmm. and I used to drive the 18 miles, go to the Blue Bend Diner, and then go and see some cool students at mm-hmm. Bennington, which was quite different than the students who were rather pusillanimous at Williams College. But when you were running this this film society, you were in search of something that maybe you're in search of now as well, which is this form of intensity.
The school, well, it's also another version of a little perfect world. There's literally a square building called Tishman, yeah. windowless
you describe
building
it.
On the campus that because I was a student worker. I had to have some job to be at Bennington because I needed so much financial aid. By running the Film Society, I could hire myself as the projectionist. So I would, I had to run for election. And as a freshman, it was very peculiar that I ran and then beat all these well-known, you know, juniors and seniors who wanted to run the Film Society. But I was completely obsessed. And I think people just sort of saw me and they were like, oh God, let him have it. That kid is so annoying. And then I was in charge, so I could hire myself, and I fired all the other projectionists. And when a film would come in, we were supposed to do 3 screenings of every film twice a week. There'd be a film twice a week, and so I would screen it, at 7 and 10 the night before, and then at noon the next day, and then I'd pack it up and ship it back to the rental place. And so I would see these movies 3 times in less than 24 hours, and it was like that building became my little utopian preserve. But also, I was a little bit like a troll under a bridge. I didn't let anyone else, do anything I didn't approve of in that space. So, yeah.
And what you approved of back then was particularly a passion you developed for Westerns, and in particular, a passion for John Ford, and in particular, a passion for John Wayne in The Searchers.
Well, it was a.
And you speak about it fantastically. I must say this. It's not a new flattery. In The Disappointed Artist, I just love that essay,
thanks.
Which is called, I think, An Obsession. Monument Valley counts for you. Have you been there?
I've been to Monument Valley. It's funny. I was just talking about this. I went to Monument Valley and I genuflected before the shapes that I saw in The Searchers. But I also, it always makes me think of someone I know who is an even greater obsessive, film scholar Joseph McBride, who went to Monument Valley in the 70s and found some of the Native Americans who'd worked with John Ford as extras in The Searchers and had them lead him to the ruins of the burned cabin from that film, and he took home a vial of ashes, which I sort of envy him owning those ashes. But Paul, the thing about that encounter that I had that I describe in the essay, I was guessing that I liked the film. I hadn't seen it yet when
you got quite upset at the reaction.
I got really angry at people for
laughing.
I defended a film I hadn't seen yet, and I accused them of kind of heresy for not liking it. And then I had to watch as it unfolded, and it's actually a film that presents tremendous awkwardnesses and it's very embarrassing and squalid. The humor is very broad. There's a lot that you can. It's indefensible. It's very, very hard to.
But you came to its rescue.
I wanted to protect this.
My story about Monument Valley is I drove from Philadelphia to California. I was got a fellowship at the Getty. I was a jolly good fellow at the Getty before it went to the Magic Mountain, still in Santa Monica. And I met a writer who I wonder if you know, Sis Noteboom, a Dutch writer, who we discovered within about 2 minutes of speaking to each other that we both loved Westerns, that we both had a passion for Monument Valley. And he said to me, you know, when I was walking in Monument Valley, I felt as though I was walking on subtitles. And that, yeah. that image was so powerful.
Europeans love love Westerns, and they see them, I think, in a they're it's very for them it's like an allegorical space. It's not a human space, which is one of the ways in, is to stop looking at it as sort of bogus history and to start to see it as like a Beckett play, characters on a blank page. So yeah, with subtitles, I guess, if you're in Europe, but. But also
he was walking, you know, the space, I think he also meant that the space where he was walking on Monument yeah. Valley was where the subtitles appeared yeah. when he was watching the film. So he was literally walking on them.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was kind of a sacred space for him at that yeah. moment, seeing it. But you watch those movies three times, you were saying, but you've been known to do much worse in some way. You've been known to watch yeah. Some movies 21 times.
Yeah, I just finished watching parts of a movie. I just wrote a book about a film. That'll come
what
out in November. I wrote a book about They Live. It's a John Carpenter horror science fiction movie from 1988 with a strong satirical political subtext. Not it's hardly a subtext. It's really blatant. The main character is a homeless construction worker who wanders into Los Angeles and finds a pair of basically magic sunglasses that reveal that yuppies are actually invading aliens who've come to suck the lifeblood out of... It's an allegory of Reagan-era America and completely relevant ever since. But so I just watched They Live. I had it on my computer while I was writing this little book. It's just like a 100-page monograph on They Live. And I was thinking about how many... I mean, film writers didn't have this privilege. When you read, Joseph McBride on The Searchers or David Thompson writing about a Warren Beatty movie in the 70s, you might have gotten to see the film three or four times and taken notes frantically. You wouldn't necessarily have control of that. But all I had to do was keep this disc in my computer as I wrote. The film was literally playing behind my words, and I'd rewind scenes, I could freeze stills at will. You can obsess so much more extensively than a film writer ever might have been able to before. You know, when I wasn't wearing holes in a print, in a celluloid print, or degenerating videotape.
You write in one of the chapters that you watched Star Wars, I believe, 21 times.
Yeah, but that was a mistake. I should have stopped at 19.
No. You're forgiven. You've also said that if one had to find the source, you've been so interested yourself in the whole notion of influence, the deepest possible source for the origin of your inspiration would come from Hitchcock.
Well, I think he's one of the artists I can... Who I find myself abiding with, he's a life companion, and there are just a few that feel that.
Who are some of the others? And before you even answer that question, to stay one more minute with Hitchcock, is his religious background important to you?
Well, this is a funny thing, is I don't. I'm almost autistic about spiritual matters. I don't. Catch it. I don't have the instinct.
Have you tried?
I mean, I've made myself as available to it as I suppose I feel I should have. But then again, that's part of being autistic about it. I don't know what even trying would consist of, particularly, besides sitting for longer hours in, the place where I failed to practice spirituality was in Quaker meeting houses, which are very, very lovely places. And, you know, if you like insomnia, sitting in silence with other people is even more, attractive. It's a very, very human, resonant, the rooms are beautifully modest. It's Quakers believe in unadorned churches. There's no oppressive air of ritual or no intermediaries. They've done away with, paternal figures between you and the light. There's just you and others working to be humble in this communion. Except I never could attain it, not even the beginnings of it. And I felt obliged to pretend that it, or to act like I was close, or that it was
meaningful
to me. But I was just being polite. It doesn't happen for me. But all of this is to say, I was very glad to be raised as a Quaker, and in fact, when I was presenting myself as a credible candidate for this teaching job, one of the things I realized was I'm comfortable in group facilitation. That's the sort of the drab kind of PC sounding word for it, because I went to so many Quaker youth organization weekends. I mean, I was really, until I realized I didn't fit in that whole environment, I was doing a lot of work to become like a good peer leader and a good group facilitator. And I even interned as late as my freshman year in college. Bennington has this thing called the NRT, non-resident term. It's a way of not heating the buildings in January and February. So they send you off to do something in the world. And I went back to a Quaker youth organization and interned as a kind of no longer peer, but I was a kind of somewhere between one of the adult leaders and I carved out a special role for myself. And that's where I really learned to sit with a group and act like I knew what they should do with an hour or two of their time. That's why I feel okay in a classroom. Long way around, too. When you ask about Hitchcock's religious obsession, my first thought is, no, it's not that, because I don't believe that I care about that. But on the other hand, I have tended to have an intense responsiveness to morbid Catholic artists. Graham Greene, Muriel Spark, again and again and again, I find that novelists that I really, really vibrate with have the same kind of troubled background in English, usually.
It's partly
English
why I was asking you.
And Catholicism. I don't know why.
Interesting that you mentioned Graham Greene, because as I wish to ask you about one of the very first jobs you held, making sandwiches, which led to a good understanding of how to deal with customers in a bookstore. Graham Greene in The Power and the Glory writes, "There's always a moment in childhood when the door opens and lets in the future." And it strikes me as very powerful. And there you were, making sandwiches, learning that you should not use the phone, that you should, in fact, not use the phone and deal with customers who are right in front of you.
Yeah.
And then when we spoke over the summer, I found you in, and you told me to look it up, and it's quite fascinating, in a bookstore you, I think, own, in part, Red Gap Books in Maine, and which is in Blue Hill, Maine, and was founded in 2009, I read, by Marjorie Kernan, Andre Strong, and Jonathan Lethem, as a place to keep our strong interest in all things bookish lively. It has a wide choice of used books at reasonable prices. The sections include top, I like that very much. I wonder if you wrote the copy for this. The sections include top quality fiction, art, Maine, photography, sailing, nautical, film, philosophy, etc. Espresso and cafe tables make it a pleasant place to hang out.
Yeah, I think Marge wrote that copy. And I'm a kind of a shadow partner. I mean, I've spent, unfortunately, for the same reasons that I'm, that I've moved into this complacent middle-aged phase that we were talking about, the emphasis on family, I'm not in that shop, even when I'm in residence up in Maine, I'm not in that shop as much as I'd enjoy being. Marge and Andre really run it, but I take this incredible, smug pleasure in being a bookseller again. It just feels very right to me, and having this sort of these shelves that I go and I fondle and straighten and price and erase books, you know, the prices in used books. It's restorative for me. It's something I did, you know. I mean, there maybe is where my spiritual practice hides, is in this adoration. It's a horrible adoration of these talismanic objects.
Why horrible?
Well, I just mean it's very materialistic, even if it, you know, masquerades as a love of literature. I'm a book collector, and I've always revered these things. Lydia Davis has this amazing story where she's writing about motherhood and about how she has this dictionary she cherishes. And she says, every time I touch this dictionary, I am conscious of the effort not to harm it, to leave it no more damaged.
Beautiful.
It's an ancient book that she cares immensely for. And then she says, and it's a kind of a twist of the knife, very typical of her work, she says, yet with my son, a living human being placed in my care, I cannot say the same thing. And it's, you know, and she draws this forward in her typically disturbing and intense way, and then leaves you to draw your own conclusions. But, you know, I do sometimes wonder at how much care I've lavished on what are finally, you know, treasure, physical possessions.
You feel a form of tactile inebriation in
some
way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Recognize the fetishist in you.
You know, I think the reason I'm drawing it into a kind of
a critique
uncertain moral standing is because right now so many people who feel that same tactile inebriation are claiming it as a kind of higher moral value, like as a bulwark against the electronic world, the world of ether. Books are some sort of, but you know, books are they're treasure and a technology. They're a delivery system. It's really not a moral value to love them the way I and I bet a lot of us here do. It's just a thing in life that I've spent a lot of time at.
Interestingly enough, I feel that when you are saying to me it's just a thing, you don't believe it.
Well, then, as I said, if I'm confessing any spiritual practice, it may be in this gap that you're detecting.
I think you are, because when we were upstairs in the special collections room and you were holding and maybe even slightly fondling the George Eliot handwritten lists of books she had read and some of her manuscripts, there was something I felt was happening to you.
I mean, I was looking for a getaway. Could I actually make, you know, this evening would be nice, but it would be much more exciting to get out of this building with the George Eliot in my pocket.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
I would have gladly thrown you over, Paul, for that copy.
I'm so sorry. Interestingly enough, it strikes me that you now work in a particular way. You have, I think, two computers, or at least you have one computer, I read, which is disabled of having internet.
Yeah.
You asked someone who works in electronics to not let you have either email or internet, and he said, but I can hide it for you. And you said, no, I just don't want it.
Yeah.
So that speaks, I mean, if you were lying down now, I would say to you, it speaks of a fairly addictive personality.
Yeah, I was just protecting myself from distraction. And it's sort of like the way I can't afford the luxury of insomnia anymore. To write novels while being a committed parent, I just don't think I can fool around. I can't web surf anymore. It's not okay. But again, I have these reservations about anything that might seem to be some sort of, you know, that second computer, that disabled computer, is not like my moral. Moral computer.
I did like that. It's just a commuter. That was great.
It's not a superior or exalted computer. It's just a practical necessity for me, because I will check my email like anyone would, and I just can't let that go on.
If you had to update, and maybe you are updating, the ecstasy of influence, how would you do it?
Yeah, I don't think it can be updated. I think it's a timepiece already. I mean, after you get things like David Shield's own manifesto, which pushes a similar exploration into new turf, and after the way it's been, you know, kind of become part of internet lore, I'm very proud of that. I think it's the most linked to thing in the history of Harper's website.
Read it, please.
But no, I don't feel. I mean, it more than any other piece I've ever had in my hands. It doesn't belong to me. It never belonged to me. It was sort of, you know, I was summoned to be the orchestrator of that thing. But I feel it would be impossible to find an entrance to rework it. If anything, you know, I want to argue with it myself now, or find ways to play against it, but it seems very distant from me.
Some of your major work, including the epic Fortress of Solitude and Chronic City, employs elements of what one might call surrealism or magic realism. Do you actually see yourself as part of a certain tradition in this regard? If it doesn't feel like magic realism, it doesn't feel like the magic realism of Gabriel Garcia Marquez, and presumably Latin American authors are not the core inspiration for your exploration of the alternative realities. But I'm sure there are some key influences here, and I would like to know where you might situate yourself if indeed these names have a meaning. I remember in that regard, Paul Valéry once was asked about where he belonged, and he said, you know, one doesn't quench one's thirst or inebriate oneself with wine labels.
Yeah. I have a hostility to the term magic realism. And I'm often too polite to express it.
Don't.
But, you know, because people often are offering it as a description of my work in praise. They're trying to say that they've responded to what I'm doing, and that it seems valid to them. And in fact, they're often specifically offering it as a way of distinguishing, even if this is unspoken, distinguishing those features of my work that they're calling magic realism from down-market, indigenous down-market notions like science fiction or fantasy. But I really find it a particularly useless phrase, because I find both terms are dubious, the magic and the realism, because what it presumes is that everyone consents to what realism is, and that realism is this sort of placid, sturdy, resilient, universally recognizable thing, and that now, oh, we're going to sprinkle some magic on it. And I just feel like absolutely not. I don't agree about the realism, and I don't want to reach for the magic. I don't like magic. I always thought magicians were, you know, like Doug Henning. They were really horrible people. And
Doug Henning
betrays
an American magician.
Yeah, yeah. You can find him on YouTube, I'm sure.
We are all YouTubeable.
Yeah. Yeah, and probably he's a really nice guy.
And comes from a good family.
He's probably watching us streaming right now.
Yeah.
And he's and turned
screaming
to his wife and said, "Why did he say that?"
Too bad.
But so that term actually, I mean, I am letting myself become aroused. It specifically magic realism betrays everything I understand about how I arrived at the way I make the work I make, okay? Because I just think realism as a consensual, you know, default for fiction is gone. Mimetic techniques, many of which I employ myself with great relish. When I learned to do like good mimetic techniques, I was totally thrilled. But they're in the employ of a fiction, as I understand it, that fundamentally understands itself to be an artifice, a fiction. Okay? So magic realism, I just don't want to get anywhere near those two words together. I don't like them.
I think you've been quite clear.
Yeah.
In Chronic City, your characters are intimidated by a gigantic novel entitled Obstinate Dust by Ralph Warden Meeker. This is an allusion to David Foster Wallace's Infinite Jest, perhaps. Speak about David Foster Wallace as a contemporary, as an influence, perhaps, as an inspiration for the fictional novelist Ralph Warden Meeker. This, of course, has extra relevance given the chair you will occupy.
Yeah. Oh, it's a strange, very particular and striking destiny to go and now sort of occupy this. Putting aside his accomplishment as a writer, he happens to have been one of the most beloved teachers in the classroom, I think, in our generation of writing teachers, or maybe teachers per se. We don't have privilege to be inside that relationship. No one who wasn't his student really knows what is being discussed, but something very special occurred because people testify again and again to what he gave in that transaction. So it's a sort of a mark to aspire to. That's and it'll be very much in the, you know, it's local there. I won't, because 3 years have elapsed, I won't, and it's just an undergraduate school, I won't actually teach students who worked with Wallace, but still, it's going to be feel very close at hand. Yes, the reference in Chronic City, that book, is a kind of a reference to Infinite Jest, although actually when the characters open up the book and begin reading it aloud on the subway, what they encounter is quite a lot more like another titanic, kind of imponderably ambitious novel, Dahlgren by Samuel Delaney. And so in my mind, the fictional book inside my book combines features of Infinite Jest and Dahlgren. But, you know, I'd begun Chronic City and had already written that reference into the book before he died. And I didn't know at first what to do with it. It was sort of staring at me after he committed suicide. Of course, it felt horrible to think I was supposed to take it out now, because it would be like, I'm obligated to erase him from my book as he's erased himself from the world. That was unthinkable. But at the level that I'd placed the reference, it might seem to be a chafing or a scornful one. And so I was stuck staring at it and trying to penetrate its future in my book, and I ended up bringing it back and intensifying its place in the book. So it becomes, it deepened for me.
How do you come upon the names of your characters? I mean, they have, I've written down a few, Chase Instedman, Laird Noteless, Richard Abneg, Thatcher Woodrow. They seem like overdetermined, like a tension novel, and I'm just wondering, where do you find these things? I mean, I'm always, when I ask where do you find them, I'm always reminded of Leonard Cohen's line, if he knew where inspiration came from, he would go there more often. But I'm wondering, how do you come upon these things? And
well, I don't have a great answer. There's no like algorithm or word game I play to generate them. I feel my way to them, but I do think it's like most things in the language that you use. It begins with listening, And it always strikes me that, for instance, Paul Holdengraber, that people have much more interesting names than we mostly acknowledge because we take them for granted, and that many of them would seem quite overdetermined if they were placed into fiction. And so I guess I have a slight chip on my shoulder because it's as if people think all the characters ought to be named, you know, Paul Smith and Jonathan
Paul,
Wilson.
I think Paul Holdengraber has a future.
Yeah,
I mean, certainly when I was teaching, it was quite complex for students. I mean, they usually would say Paul Holdengraber, which is quite natural.
Yeah. I guess I hear a lot of very exciting names as I move through the world, and
why,
you know,
not use them?
I just think, of course, the ones in fiction should be at least as memorable. And sometimes, yes, I'll push them into another degree of strangeness, partly because I have an interest in fiction that feels simultaneously like it's depicting our world and that it has a little itch under the skin of allegory. I don't want it to be real allegory where you can just boil it down and translate all the terms into some, oh, he just means this and this and this. I dislike allegory in its real sense, but I like, you know, for instance, as a kid, I was always very turned on by reading the annotated Alice in Wonderland and realizing that so many of the things in Lewis Carroll were references to Victorian ditties or notions that he was making fun of and that contemporary readers might translate. But I knew that I preferred my own blissful, ignorant first encounter with it, where these things had an air of translatability, but I was on the other side. They seemed charged with potential interpretations, but I couldn't make the interpretations. So sometimes I want the names to feel that way. Like if you worked really hard, you'd get somewhere, but you'd never do all that work. You'd never do it.
Have you maintained a passion for graffiti? Have you, for instance, seen the recent movie Exit Through the Gift Shop?
Oh, I want to see that. I've heard that it's good. But
tremendous, Banksy.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm interested in graffiti, but I don't... I mean, I'm interested in that movie, but I don't think of Banksy as graffiti in the sense that I... You know, for me, it has a lot to do with this experience of the vernacular culture of New York City as I grew up inside it, the birth of hip-hop and the forms of communication and possession that teenagers placed over this half-ruined, half-mad, half-dystopian city. Because in the early 70s, you know, the collective... you know, feeling about New York was it was over, it was ruined, it was being abandoned. And, you know, that was a very thrilling, dangerous but thrilling kind of place to grow up inside because it felt like maybe it was going to be turned over to us to play in. A lot of these ruined buildings were, and ruined lots were, you know, our zones. And, you know, if you put a piece of graffiti up in 1971, it might still be there in 1985. No, if you put it in the right place, no one might ever be troubled to scrub it off. The conscious street art that formed, you know, I have varying likes and dislikes, but I don't relate it so directly to this stuff.
Because it has become commodified.
Because it begins with a self-conscious, you know, art theory or art commodification, which is fine.
There's a website now.
Many wonderful artists begin in self-consciousness, but this isn't the case with the graffiti culture that I was documenting a little bit in Fortress of Solitude.
There's a website now where you can find every possible product you might need as a graffiti artist.
Yeah.
Art Primo. You just go there and you can see every possible...
Yeah. There are a lot of fetishes around that world now. And, you know, I suppose I'm complicit with that in a way by making the graffiti so legendary in the places I've written about it.
In closing, when we were talking about your departure, you mentioned that it coincides not only with your middle class aspirations, but also with rather ambitious projects that you're undertaking now. So it is the middle class aspirations might be modulated, as it were, well, by the ambitious projects. And I wonder if you could slightly disclose what they might be.
Yeah, slightly. The great quote about that is Flaubert, who said, "Be ordinary and bourgeois in your everyday life, so that you may be violent and original in your work." And it's not just and be violent and original, but it's so that it's for him. It was one procedure opens the other. I'm starting a very big, crazy novel about Queens, about Sunnyside, and it's set at the end of the 1950s and the beginning of the 1960s, principally, although it sprawls a bit and almost gets to the present day. Certainly we'll go through the 70s and 80s a little bit. In that sense, it's structurally the most like Fortress of Solitude. And in a way, you could almost call it a Fortress of Solitude for my mother's generation instead of my own. It's about the place, time and place where she pulled away from her outer borough life, brought herself out of the ethnic enclaves of Queens. In her case, she was a red diaper baby, and Sunnyside was a place where communists had gone to, again, initially to set up, a perfect socialist suburb, and then with the Stalin purges being revealed in the mid-50s, they all were embittered and disappointed and had to stare at each other and not talk about their beliefs anymore. And my mother grew up in this place with these very specific kind of disappointed communists all around her. And she pulled herself out of Queens, dropped out of Queens College at age 17 and kind of ran away to Greenwich Village where the first stirrings of the folk scene were happening. And she hung out on McDougal Street. So I'm sort of...
What year would that be?
61, 59, 60, 61, 62. I'm sort of taking this raw material of my grandmother and my mother as a bridge from the 50s to the 60s and one version of an American leftist commitment, American communism, explicit communist belief, and then the kind of birth of the new left counterculture in the folk scene in Greenwich Village.
We shared a common experience in April by 2 or 3 days apart, both interviewing or conversing with Patti Smith, which for me was, I just have to admit it in front of everybody. I mean, I just fell in love. And I wasn't prepared for it, as one often is when one falls in love, one isn't quite prepared for it. I'm sure you grew up listening to a lot of Patti Smith. I discovered Patti Smith as I turned 50. I'm wondering, what did you learn the evening or the afternoon when you interviewed her? What did you learn that you didn't know about her? That's not the 50s, late 50s, early 60s, but rather she was talking about the grittiness of New York that she misses now.
It's funny. You followed... my rambling just then with this question, because she actually unexpectedly reminded me of my mother. Her physical presence, in a way, in person, was very, very different from the image she projects, and that was as intense as anything that was exchanged personally. And she's very, very beatific, warm person to be, a splendid person to be in the presence of. She sang a song on stage for me. I don't know if she did this for you, Paul.
She did.
Yeah. And she sang it looking into my eyes.
She didn't do that for me.
Yeah. And I have to say, that overwhelmed any yakety yak. That was the takeaway, was she sang a song looking into my eyes.
Well, I must say she did do something for me, which was quite special. I don't mean to outdo what she did for you. But the way I was aroused was she wrote to me the day of the event, not having communicated before, saying that she very much liked the idea of going to see the special collections, and we took her up, and she touched
Virginia Woolf's cane, and her knees were sort of trembling, saying, Paul, what are you doing?
She's a real collector.
She's a fetishist. Yeah. I mean, she's really deeply. And she, in this message she wrote to me, saying that she very much liked and was looking forward to going and seeing these special items, the last line, I think after her signature, was, shall I bring my guitar? And I remember thinking, and she had said before that the ideas were cool, and I was trying to say to myself, okay, Paul, remain cool. And I was pacing up and down in my apartment, thinking, I'm not going to respond immediately. And then I said, well, if you'd like to bring your guitar, please do. And then, but she, one of the things I discovered is that she adores opera. I mean, as you know from the book, she really just, and adores Maria Callas.
And it's another thing, is her book, if you guys haven't read it, it's an extraordinarily good memoir. Just great book to read.
Just kids.
I'll tell you one thing that we said that stayed with me. A lesson to writers. I mean, something that happened in our conversation that I feel I'll bring into the writing classroom. I mean, in the past, in her poetry and in some of the prose poems that she's published, Patti Smith has been a very esoteric, verging on abstract writer in many ways. And she knows this and you know, made herself into that kind of writer. But this narrative of her life with Mapplethorpe is pure testimony, pure storytelling. And it's built out of, you know, the most fundamentally sound kind of scene construction. And I asked her, where did this come from and why is it so different? And did she consciously put aside the more esoteric or evocative, you know, poetical style that was, as far as I knew, her only writing style to that point? And she said, well, I was writing this book for Bob, for Mapplethorpe, and that he didn't ever have any patience with her abstract stuff. And she wanted it to be a book he would have liked to read. So she was always consciously excluding anything that wouldn't have worked for him, and that's how she ended up in this place. And I just thought, you know, obviously it's a very moving thought, since the companion is gone, the recipient is gone, but this idea that you get to that kind of honesty and that kind of persuasiveness by remembering that you're writing to someone, that every book, every piece is a piece of transmission, a letter, essentially, from you to a listener, some listener.
Jonathan Leeson, thank you very much. Thank you. There's a microphone, and there may be even some good questions. Come on up.
Hey there.
I'm interested in your painting, why you gave it up. Do any of your old paintings exist? And are any for sale?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I mean, you know, I grew up with my father's painting, and he is still my first and deepest model of commitment to, you know, art practice. He just goes into a studio every day, and it bothers him if he doesn't, and he just makes work. And this was so meaningful to me. And then I also had this sort of weird luck, genetic luck of, I inherited his, you know, hand and eye thing. I could kind of impress people. I can draw in a way that that turns on art teachers and made them think I was a hot ticket. But in some other sense, I was always so utterly unlike him in my engagement with language, narrative, storytelling. I always, as many museums and galleries as I was taken to and enjoyed being taken to as a kid, and I have a lot of, you know, art vocabulary, art literacy, it was books that blew me away and that I took into myself and it became personal. So the game, the dance as a kid of being a, you know, a little art prodigy felt very exciting to me. It was, I was making myself into the kind of person I wanted to be because the two are not that distant, you know. Having a life as a painter or having a life as a novelist both involve a lot of the same fundamental kinds of commitment to solitude and, you know, self interrogation of your interests and influences and trying not to repeat yourself and trying to avoid cliches. And, you know, so the training for one was perfectly applicable to the other. And it was fun being an art kid. It meant that in high school, instead of going to, like, social studies or math classes, I was often doing things like, I mean, in high school, I carved marble stone, you know. By the time, even before I'd gotten to college, I'd spent hundreds of hours in art classrooms, and that's just a nice way to spend your teenage life. But I somehow knew I was meant to be a writer. I had another kind of thing going on between me and the books. So the one was always lurking behind the other, and I was never actually in doubt of it, just as it happened. Thank you. Oh, yeah, right. Oh, so a very small handful of paintings exist, and I think they're in my dad's storage space, a few of them. There's only two or three I would ever let anyone look at. They're mostly just really sophomoric. I mean, one of the weird giveaways is the way I painted was very narrative and cartoonish, and there were always characters, and sometimes even words would come in. I painted a lot of words on the canvas. It was like they're begging you to say, oh, just go and start writing, you know? There's a book called The Writer's Brush, which is this big coffee table compendium of paintings and drawings by writers. Yeah, you know, and it's very flattering because it goes all the way back to, like, Victor Hugo and, you know, Borges has a drawing in there, and there are lots and lots of, you know, John Ashbery has collages, and John Updike has cartoons in it because he was a cartoonist before he was a novelist. And I think I'm the youngest person featured in it, so it's sort of neat to be, like, bringing up the rear in this, you know, compendium of the dilettantes. But I know I was not ever really a painter. I don't like that kind of, like, you know, and even when I do fool around now, I don't pretend that anyone should look at it just because I'm a writer. You know, it's a real commitment, and I never made it. And in fact, the best of my art teachers saw through me. They saw the facility was like I was just kind of like, hey, look at that. And they would often try to have these stern talks with me about how they could see I wasn't really there.
It'll be interesting to see how the students will feel when you see through them now. Well, it'll be difficult because in some way some of them will probably be writing to impress you.
Yeah, but very few of them will be as obnoxious as I was at that age. I was really, because I'd gone to art school as a teenager and because my dad was a painter and I could just play the role so confidently. When I got to college and I was, you know, when I talk of these best of my art teachers who confronted me, I'm talking about at Bennington in the first, you know, year or two there. I was really a jerk because I was acting like I was just going to have like an art career without caring about one. I just seemed to think it was mine to be had, and they needed to step up and say something. I was fooling around. Whereas for me, even though I was much worse as a writer when I first started writing, I didn't have any of those advantages. I was quite incompetent. But I was in the grip of something that mattered to me, and the commitment was real. The talent, you know, took quite a long time to show. I mean, I was not encouraged by the people who I showed my first writings to. But it didn't matter. I was just there. I was doing what mattered to me, and it was different.
In one of the last essays of the disappointment artist, you write about this, what I love, it's this level of utter absorption. You say, I couldn't bear to listen to Talking Heads records, even the ones I previously revered after Naked and after David Byrne's early solo records. That subsequent music seemed to me, to my fierce acolyte heart, a betrayal of the idea of the Talking Heads, as though David Byrne were an unworthy steward of the art he'd partly created. All their music became poisonously embarrassing to me at the moment I realized it wasn't as good as I'd claimed it was, and no band is as good as I'd claimed Talking Heads were in the years I adored them. I suffered other similar, if milder, divorces. From the surrealist painters Magritte and de Chirico, from Jean-Luc Godard and Brian Eno and David Bowie, these disappointments I managed to modulate. The artists are less like ex-lovers and like friends I keep in my address book, but call less often than I used to. It was my splits from Talking Heads and Stanley Kubrick and Don DeLillo that left me indignant, ashamed, and unmoored as breakups with a girlfriend or wife, wondering who'd failed whom. And then you say, attempting to burrow and disappear into the admiration of certain works of art, I tried to make such deep and pure identification that my integrity as a human self would become optional, a vestige of my relationship to the art. I downloaded art into myself. Love these
Thank
words.
You.
It's as if for you to exist in that world, you need to set up such a high expectation that a natural disappointment will come.
Yeah, I'm guilty of loading the stakes. And then I sometimes have made that problem a subject in my work. I mean, both, you know, Dylan Ebdus in Fortress of Solitude and Perkis Tooth in Chronic City are trying to make culture sustain them like food and oxygen. You know, they're trying to get and human companionship. They're trying to make a whole world out of their cultural stuff, and it fails them. So I guess I exist in a kind of a tension between that semi-religious reverence and the more pragmatic, you know, the fall, the disappointment of being finally, you know,
let down.
Cast back, well, let down, but also in a sense returned to the other parts of being human. You know, I've made a life in culture, but one of the things we've spoken of, you know, almost flippantly here, I also sustain myself in the life of my family now, and it's best to have both of those things. I mean, not specifically two little children or any other kind of family arrangement. I'm not proposing a preference. I just mean a human life.
Unless there are other questions, I think it's not a bad thing to end on a human life, but there is another question, so we might end on not a human life.
Hi.
Go ahead.
So I'm also a writer, and I guess as many writers, I have a lot of anxiety. So I was given the advice to exercise more, so I was excited to read in an interview that you write on a treadmill.
I tried to set this up, and I'm gonna set it up again in California. I built it myself, and I'm not very good at these kinds of constructions, but I got a computer with a wireless keyboard, so the two don't have to be attached, and the keyboard is sort of weirdly with a combination of like wood, and I used this weird piece of hardware that I found and bungee cords. I kind of have the computer screen is tilted up, and the keyboard is on the across where, you know, you ordinarily program the treadmill. And I never really was able to make this work. But I really am excited about the idea that I might find a way to do it. And I, even just the fact that I was sometimes walking and writing seemed really revolutionary to me. I mean, there's this, you know, I was just speaking of being an art student and carving stone. I mean, I had amazing arms in high school. And, you know, there is this sort of joke about painters live forever because they're like up on their feet, you know, moving their arms around, and writers all sit, you know, you're like moving the least part of your body. And then one day you just fall over and they don't even notice that you died. So I want to try to find a way. I do miss, you know, it's not like I think there's some difference that will happen in the writing, but, you know, with the zero sum of my family life, you know, if I could combine a little bit of aerobics with all those hours that I spend twitching my fingers, it would be a very good thing. Yeah.
I feel like it kind of diffuses like the anxious creative energy that would otherwise go into your... Like, do you just get sleepy? Because after I exercise, I just get sleepy.
Oh, I guess I never got up to a good enough pace to get sleepy. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for the question. Good luck with the work. I see somebody.
Come on up.
Come on up.
Hey. Hi. Sorry. I didn't try to make it quick. I know you're trying to wrap it up. I was curious about the seed stage of what when you write, and if something that ended up as a novel ever could have been expressed as an essay, or vice versa, or like how that unfolds for you, I guess, basically.
Yeah.
My answer from my seat.
Thank you. Well, you know, I don't ever feel like I've mistaken one thing for another in that way that I think you're proposing. And you know, novels, they don't just suddenly, you know, you don't sort of have one seed and then you see a little sprout a couple of days later and you're writing a novel. For me anyway, they're this accumulation of sometimes, to begin with, things I don't know are related to one another. Different feelings, different set pieces, different kinds of character or story or crisis or something that I begin to put into relation to one another, and I begin to think, you know, for instance, oh, the graffiti and oh, the you know, the being bullied and superheroes and, you know, liner notes and soul music and this kind of character that I've never done before. Oh, this all does belong together. I'm thinking about it for a reason. But this happens over a period of years. And I've always been thinking about a novel for years, even if it's in very nascent, very inchoate ways, before I begin anything, before I even take a note, I've usually been kind of mulling or just living with some half-formed stuff that starts to clump together. Novels are really, you know, it's a very baggy art form. Even the least baggy novels, the most kind of apparently slim and elegant and on-point novels that you could think of, they still have so many different things in them compared to most other art forms. They're so various, the numbers of characters and situations and sentences and approaches usually that are all hiding under that one, you know, umbrella. And so that for me is always this agglomerating kind of thing. Whereas a short story or an essay is not the opposite exactly, but it's when something seems to have a very clear container around it. It just doesn't agglomerate. Instead, it sort of sits there. I mean, and there it doesn't mean I don't sometimes think about those for years. There's an essay I want to write right now that I've had the title and the idea for it just sitting for a long time, and I kind of know exactly how it's going to work, and it just needs writing. And it doesn't open onto other territories. It doesn't complicate. It's just waiting. So that's an essay.
Thank you so very much. We will miss you.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Thank you. Yeah.